Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode here at the Damage Report. Very exciting day in the news, not only because we've got an awesome rundown for you of news from across the US and indeed around the world, but because we also have a special treat for you. Today is a Thursday where we bring in guest co-hosts, and we've got a special one for you. For the first time ever on TDR, although by far not the first time on TYT, culture and NBA writer for The Athletic, Wasni Lambre, welcome to the Damage Report.
What's going on, my brother? I'm good. I'm chilling, man. It's an honor to finally get the call up to come on Damage Report, because as you know, I've co-hosted with Anna on the quote unquote main show. We're gonna make this the main show now.
Yeah, we joke about that. As of right now, I think that this is a call down, considering that you did the main show earlier this week, but you've been called down to our level, but no, we're very excited to have you. I talked about it on the show briefly, on the main show yesterday, and I know people are really excited to have you here.
Man, thank you. I appreciate that.
So for people who might not be familiar with you from your many appearances on the main show, tell us a little bit about your work.
Well, you know, I'm a writer for The Athletic. I write about the NBA, and mainly, I guess my beat, if you will, is the NBA and its intersection with culture, whether that be politics, entertainment, movies, TV, fashion, you name it. Where the NBA sort of intersects with society's culture at large, which it does in many ways. I think people would be surprised to find how intertwined it all is, right? Like LeBron James campaigning for Joe Biden and them, right? Like, and doing a Space Jam movie, right? Like, the NBA has its tentacles in so many other things, and I'm interested in those other things. And so I try to sort of write, you know, within that hue. Some of you listeners might know me from a podcast that I do with Nando Vila called The Woke Bros, originally founded with my brother, rest in peace, Michael Brooks. And the three of us were doing it. And of course, Mike passed untimely, tragically for all of us. And, you know, me and Nando have decided to carry the torch in Mike's honor, of course, in service of, you know, normal working people, right? Like, some people got it good and are rich and they don't need to have kids, right? Like, they're gonna have two vacation homes no matter what. We like to do our show centered around the things that affect people who work for a living, you know, people who are worried about their bills, are worried about rent and mortgage payments, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, that's what I do. That's what I try to do. We try to keep it light, try to keep it funny. But you know, we want to inform the people and we want to keep them entertained.
Nice, that's awesome. Hopefully we will accomplish that goal here as well. Thank you to everybody who's already here watching, regardless of what platform you're on. We appreciate you being here. You can, of course, hit the like button and share the stream so that people know we're live. And as we go through this hour of news, we would love to have your comments, questions, concerns, and all of that. We'll be responding between stories. And in fact, to get it started, I saw this comment on Twitch from Jonah, who says, "Waz, do you think Kyle Lowry gets traded today?"
Yeah, he's getting moved. I think you could tell by the tenor of his press conference last night that it was sort of a goodbye press conference. Shouts to Drizzy Drake for interrupting the press conference. Lowry was doing his Zoom presser thing, and Drake FaceTimed him and he said hello to the assembled media. But yeah, Kyle Lowry is getting moved. It's looking like he's probably going home to Philadelphia to play for the Sixers, who really, really could use the type of point guard leadership, floor generalship that Kyle Lowry provides. But it's looking like he's on the move to Philly, and I think that's gonna make their team much, much better.
Okay. I would add something, but I won't for two reasons. One, I think you really covered it, and two, I don't know anything about what you just talked about. But but I'm glad that you do. I do. I'm familiar with the NBA, but then I capped out right there. And I think FaceTime. I know FaceTime. Those are the two parts of that I got. By the way, I don't know. Maybe this is a heads up to the director. Apparently, my video is going across in low frame rate. So don't know what that's about, or if it's a thing that we can fix. But I don't know. Maybe this will give us a really cinematic experience. But anyway, glad to have you here. And with that, why don't we jump into our first topic? Fox News has been pushing for Joe Biden to have a press conference for some time. And what do you know? They're gonna get what they want, because we are on the precipice of the first formal press conference for Joe Biden. Not the first time that he's talked to the news. He's interacted with the news in a lot of different ways, but none of that counted for some reason. But anyway, Fox and Friends is very excited, not just because Biden will have to answer questions about the various crises facing America, but because they think something's gonna happen, as will be clear in this clip from Fox and Friends.
I wonder what kind of preparation. I'm sure it's a lot more than a minute or two he's putting in, and we'll see how he does, because this is not his ideal format, the back and forth and the jostling that happens in a press briefing.
Kaylee, I can barely understand what he's saying with the mask on. I don't know if that's on purpose or what. And we talked earlier about how he hasn't met with the Republican side. Sometimes I wonder, maybe it's not that he doesn't want to work together or pretend like he's working together with them. Maybe they just don't want to show how badly he's declining. I mean, I can't understand him. And there seems to be such little access, and they know that we have these questions. What else could be the reason?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Rachel. It's a scripted presidency. It's a soundbite presidency. You remember President Trump let cameras in when he was with Nancy Pelosi. So even when he was with friend or foe, the cameras were always in. He was always taking questions. But this is a scripted presidency. They put him in these very short moments. His speeches are even short. They're a few minutes most of the time. There's no long address. And you've got to ask, you know, why is he not giving this joint address to Congress? This is your opportunity to go forward with a positive agenda and optimistic agenda, lay out your what you plan. He's not doing it. Can he do it? I think is the question that we're all asking. And today's going to be a big test for President Biden, his biggest yet, at least when it comes to public relations.
Yeah, and arguably not the most important test, since it just has to do with public relations, not with dealing with a pandemic or something like that. Anyway, I probably shouldn't have 1,000 thoughts. I have 1,000 thoughts, but first, Wozni, what do you think?
You know, it's Fox. They've clearly haven't decided the sort of angle that they want to take in their mode of attack for Joe Biden, right? With Barry, it was simple. Look at the guy. He's black. Yeah. He's Muslim. Like, the line of attack was so clear and easy for them. They focused in on that, like, you know, like with laser precision, and they just went about otherizing the guy. And that's what they did for 8 years, and it was very easy. With Joe Biden, it's a little harder. They can't come out and sort of talk crap about the only important policy decision he's made so far, which is the $2 trillion in stimulus, because as you and I both know, John, that thing is a smoker. That thing has 75% approval rating amongst all Americans. So they can't come out and kill him for that. So yep, they have to grasp at straws and say, oh, why is he so scripted? I mean, is he gonna come out and suggest that people drink bleach and detergent? Who knows, right?
I bet that he wouldn't. But yeah, and so you're totally right. They've taken basically, they're not sure exactly what they should say about Biden, so they're just going with what Trump said about Biden. It's Sleepy Joe. This is just another version of Sleepy Joe, which, look, that's an attack, and their fans seem to like it, and Trump has fun with it. But is that the most effective attack? Because they simultaneously want to call him sleepy and he's barely alive, he's not really in control, but also he's super extreme and dangerous and you should be terrified about what he's gonna do. Like, maybe a Fox viewer who wants to believe both of those things can try, but it's not gonna be as natural as, look at that guy, he's really, really black. I mean, you can look at him and he's totally black. Like, that's a direct through line to every racist bone in Fox viewers' bodies.
Yeah, I mean, Joe Biden is not gonna fist bump his black wife, right?
You know, like, probably not.
It's gonna be a little bit tougher for them to peg him and pigeonhole him into certain categories. And again, if he continues to just do things that are popular amongst even Fox News voters, I mean viewers, then they're tough, man. They're between a rock and a hard place. If it was by chance a woman or someone who was basically non-white, it's kind of easy for Fox News to get their digs in, right? Like, they could call the person emotional, or they could call the person radical, or whatever. They can paint this person as different, or, you know, having these iniquities, or whatever the case may be. But because Joe Biden is just, he's old. He fits the other qualifications, which is white and male, but he's old. old and straight, by the way, because that also matters. But you know, it's tough. They're struggling, man. You see, they rather go with the culture war stuff recently. They're going with the Dr. Seuss and Mr. Potato Head, and the liberals are going crazy with PC. Like they are so stuck for material. It's like being in a writer's room and just having writer's block. The material is just not coming to them quite as naturally as it once did.
Totally. And that stuff, while their fans like the Seuss and the Potato Head and whatever, that doesn't really have anything to do with Biden.
Right.
So like, does that really help to build a narrative that Biden's a disaster, that you have to vote him out of office in 4 years? Not necessarily. And I would also say, strategically, if what you really hope is that Biden is going to be slow Alzheimer, is so Alzheimer that he's not going to be able to get through a press conference, you're lowering expectations by saying that in advance. Yeah. I mean, it's not, and by the way, not for their audience. Like, they can say he's going to stumble through it, he's going to be a disaster. And whether he does or not, their audience isn't going to know, because their audience isn't going to watch the press conference. They're going to maybe see 30 of the worst seconds from Sean Hannity. That's it. But the larger, like, American audience is going to be told that he can barely get through a speech. And if he can, then that doesn't help their narrative. It's just
and I think it's another thing that our viewers should understand as well. Another thing they can't do is go on here and say, well, Joe Biden's not deregulating American business enough. He's not, you know, slashing enough taxes for the richest people in America. Like, he's not doing enough of what Mitch McConnell and Trump's basically the only policy stuff that they can hang their hat on after 4 years was a record-breaking, record-setting tax cut for extremely wealthy Americans. So Fox can't spend all day saying, well, they're not doing that, because they know nobody wants that or cares about that, right? So again, they got bubkis.
That is true. Okay. Yeah, we'll see. And by the way, like, there are criticisms to make of Biden, but as Wazi pointed out in the beginning, those would be substantive critiques that would get into what the American people really want, and Fox News doesn't want to talk about that. We critique Biden all of the time. Like, for instance, if I had a question, and Waz, I'll give you a chance, what question would you ask him? But if I had a question, I would say, you promised a billion times you're going to cancel student loan debt. You could do it right now with your signature. You could literally stop for a minute and do it right now. I'll give you a pen, I'll give you a paper, you could do it. Why aren't you doing that? That's a question, but Fox doesn't want to get into that, because they don't want student loan debt to be canceled, even though that's what the American people want. So that would be my question. Exactly. What would you ask?
I would ask him about the infrastructure bill that they've already started to doing the PR around. Because we saw with the stimulus, they treated it as, this is an emergency, this has to happen. We'll do the quote unquote bipartisan lip service, and then we'll watch McConnell and the rest of the flunkies in the GOP completely ignore it, completely say, we're gonna stand in front of anything you try to do for normal working class Americans. And they said, this is too important to be left up to these goons, right? And they smashed it through via budget reconciliation and kept it pushing. It's like, we tried, y'all failed, we're keeping it pushing. I want to know if they're going to take a similar tact, if they view this this infrastructure bill as just as vital as they so clearly viewed the stimulus. So that's what I would want to know. Are you going to treat this as, you know, level one emergency type of thing?
Yeah, we'll see. I have my doubts. I think it's a good question.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Bernie Sanders has been quite supportive of the workers at Amazon who are trying to unionize and to a lot of different union efforts. That's a consistent position he's had for like half a century. And that isn't necessarily something that Amazon is big fans of. So recently, Dave Clark, who's Amazon's consumer chief, said, "I welcome the senator to Birmingham and appreciate his push for a progressive workplace. I often say we, Amazon, are the Bernie Sanders of employers. But that's not quite right because we actually deliver a progressive workplace for our constituents, a $15 minimum wage, healthcare from day one, career progression, and a safe and inclusive work environment." So if you want to hear about $15 an hour in healthcare, Senator Sanders will be speaking downtown. But if you would like to make at least $15 an hour and have good healthcare, Amazon is hiring. So that is bold from a representative of the corporate monstrosity that is Amazon. All of that on Twitter. This is an official representative of Amazon who I have read has the nickname, I think, the sniper, because he used to lurk in the shadows in warehouses at Amazon and fire people if they weren't working hard enough. So I don't know if that's true, but either way, very cool guy. Wozni, what did you think about his response to Bernie Sanders' recent advocacy?
Stick to what you know, brother. You don't do internet speak. You don't do internet snark, clearly. And you clearly don't know the record and the life of one Bernard Sanders. Like, you need to watch your mouth. Slow your roll and watch your mouth, brother. That's what I would say to him. And you know, I love this idea that a company that has grown Jeff Bezos's personal wealth, $50 billion since the pandemic has started, could come out and brag about the fact that they pay the employees that fundamentally have a hand in making that so, $15 an hour, as if that was some damn thing to throw a parade about. It's embarrassing. And honestly, the point of a union is not just to, you know, guarantee livable pay wages, right? It's about the material working conditions at the job site. It's about what can be expected of you as far as your workflow. And management just can't jerk you around, because when it's Amazon against one man, that one, you're toast. They will crush you in no time. But if it's Amazon against the collective workforce that allows for them to collect these immeasurable amounts of riches, that's a different proposition. And that's totally when you see actual concessions being had. And it won't just be, oh, we give you benefits and we give you $15. While we do need those things, and we need more than $15 if we're being real for somebody as rich as Amazon. So I like the framing. You know, if you don't like the answer, change the question. That's exactly what that dude just tried to do there. But the unionization effort is about much more than just the wages. It's about everything that goes into being an employee and feeling like you're not having the life and soul sucked out of you every time you show up to work.
Totally. Yeah. And we have some examples of how that soul sucking actually works. But I want to add to what you said. You said, you know, like that they give power and then they have this big party that we should be so excited about it. But also, and that they would pretend that they just did that because it was an idea that they had. It had nothing to do with what anyone else was doing. No, it was due to two things, primarily Fight for 15 and labor activists working for years and years and years and years. But amongst politicians, look, there are some great politicians that have been pushing for $15 or more an hour. I think notably Bernie Sanders was one of those over the past half decade or so. Like, the idea that if he hadn't been pushing for these things, that Amazon would have just done it to act right, that Walmart would have done it, that Disney wouldn't have changed. Like, they were pressured by him. That's part of the reason that Dave Clark is so incredibly salty about Bernie Sanders, specifically because of how Bernie Sanders intersected with Amazon's policies. But anyway, there's another layer to this that goes beyond Bernie Sanders. So Representative Mark Pocan, He responded to that tweet from Dave Clark saying paying workers $15 an hour doesn't make you a progressive workplace when you union bust and make workers urinate in water bottles. And you might think, oh, this is gonna get bad because Dave Clark is gonna double down. No, it's worse than that. Amazon News, which is a thing, they responded to that saying, you don't really believe the peeing in bottles thing, do you? If that were true, nobody would work for us. The truth is that we have over 1 million incredible employees around the world who are proud of what they do and have great wages and healthcare from day one. So I love to get my unbiased news from Amazon News about the news about Amazon. That's what I love, Wazzy.
I don't even know where to start there. Let's start with just the idea that workers wouldn't allow themselves to be exploited in order to put food on the table and to pay their rent. Excuse me, these are things that actually exist. If I don't work at Amazon, if I don't go out and find somewhere to get some paper, I'm cooked. I'm on the streets and nobody's gonna give a damn about me, especially not in these United States of America. So when workers are faced with basically financial ruin, and you know, bodily ruin from, you know, not having healthcare, et cetera, or exploitative working conditions, excuse me, everybody's gonna pick the terrible working conditions rather than, you know, moving a skid row, right? Yeah. So that argument is just laughable. And secondly, I want people to understand that there's not a single gain that's ever been made in the struggle between labor and management. That happened because management or capital or our oligarchs or our overseers or our rulers, whatever we want to call them, by the goodness of their hearts said, oh, you want a 5-day work week? Here you go. You want sick leave? Come on, I got you. PTO, I got you. Workman's comp, I got you. You want to end child labor? I got you. Overtime pay, I got. No, they never did any of that for us. Labor had to fight for every single one of these things. So this idea that Amazon is just such a great zaddy and they're just gonna rain the little dollar bills on us because we shake our little tushies for them, it's nonsense. It's laughable, dude. Like, we know what it takes to get these concessions. It has to be fight. Like, power never concedes power to nothing. You know, they have threats have to be lobbied. The bottom line has to be threatened, you know, and that's how we get advancements in working conditions, man. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, even the companies that have moved to a $15 an hour, it wasn't because like Dave Clark walked out onto the line and he was like, they look stressed and underappreciated. What can I do? Yeah, no, it's they're trying to get out in front of legislation that might be even more stringent in the requirements. They're trying to push that off. He's literally doing it in real time in that Twitter thread. He's saying, don't trust progressive pro-worker politicians, trust your corporate overlords. That is the point of that. And Amazon News is just buttressing it. Now, really fast, just because they did reference the pee thing, the reference to warehouse workers peeing in bottles out of desperation. This is the second most mainstream pee story in American politics over the past decade. I'll let you fill in the blanks on the first one. The reference to warehouse workers peeing in bottles out of desperation originates from a claim made by the British author James Bloodworth back in 2018 after he went undercover at an Amazon warehouse. He told Insider at the time that he had come across a bottle of urine on a warehouse shelf and that workers were admonished for taking toilet breaks. Drivers of Amazon affiliated courier companies also told Insider that some workers urinated in bottles to save time on the road. And I apologize, this we're not CNN, we don't have a huge budget and all that. I had seen a reference to a journalist who saw official documentation for Amazon workers on what they had to do to clean out their workplaces before they left for their shift. And it specifically had a reference to bottles of urine that they could not leave behind, bodily waste and stuff like that. I went to find it for the production of the show today and I couldn't find it again, but it does exist, I swear. Anyway, and by the way, to the point that they make about if this was true, no one would want to work for us. Well, Wazzy, I think, brilliantly responded to that. But in addition, there was a survey by the worker rights platform Organize that found that 74% of workers avoid using the toilet at Amazon for fear of being warned that they had missed their target numbers. Rising goals have also taken a toll on employees' mental health, as 55% of them report having suffered depression since working at Amazon. Over 80% of workers said they would not apply for a job at Amazon again. So maybe that's something for Amazon News, the journalists there, to look into.
These people have a lot of nerve. It's amazing. And you know, the part about mental health, I think, is important, is an important note, right? Oftentimes you get a job and you're paying your bills, but like, what good is it if the strain that is being put on you spiritually and mentally, you don't even get to enjoy the fruits of your labor. You can't even enjoy the time when you're not at work, spending with family, because this job is so physically taxing and mentally draining. That becomes its own other thing in and of itself. So, you know, The conditions are such that they treat workers as if they are literally robots. They literally say the only reason you guys are here is because we can't get robots that know how to pick things up. We haven't invented those robots yet. It's insane the way they sort of they frame how the workers' importance in the workplace as, you guys are inessential, we don't need you, so we get to treat you like trash. Oh yeah, by the way, we're tracking your every movement. We're gonna make sure you're as efficient as possible, because again, you're not a human being, you're just the instrument by which we extract cash. And it's awful. It's like out of some, you know, post-apocalyptic crazy novel. You know what I'm saying? Like the way they treat these workers, like you're just the number.
Yeah, as soon as they are able, like that guy will say, like, screw Bernie Sanders, we love our workers. If he could make a robot today that would duplicate it, he would put it in there. Even if the robot had to urinate oil every once in a while, he would replace it with the robot. And by the way, the audience is telling me that Nina Turner actually tweeted out the graphic that I was referencing. So that's a place you can definitely look if you want to see that. I just want to finalize the section. We had a little bit. Rashida Tlaib apparently was trying to talk to workers. They called the cops on her. Absolutely insane. But also, today is the 110th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire, a horror that killed 146 low-paid workers. You can see there a front page from back then. That was one of the tragedies, of which there were many tragedies like that, where workers just like the conditions were set up to save a little bit of money. And if it kills a few hundred people, then who cares? That is one of the things that led to some unionization and labor reforms. But I mean, it's been a long time. There was a lot done, you know, 70 years ago. How much is still being done? Like every 5 years or so, how far forward are we moving? And if we are, if we start to again, if we ever get back that sort of pro-worker zeal that like very briefly was a part of American politics, it is not going to be from people like whoever the management of Amazon happens to be. It's going to be from people like Bernie Sanders or others. And there's thankfully a good number in politics these days.
Yeah, it's important that we don't disentangle politics from, you know, disentangle politics from the issues that afflict working people. Matt Karp was on our show with me and Nando, and he talked about how this is basically a new Gilded Age, where in the Gilded Age you've seen politics were extremely like polarized, and the issues, the discourse centered around sort of culture war type of stuff, and was disentangled from money, power, who gets it, who gets to distribute it, and why and how. And I think a lot of people like Bernie, like AOC, like Ilhan Omar are trying to do their work to make sure that within the political sphere, we're talking about inequality, we're talking about workers' rights, we're talking about, you know, how stratified everything is. And CEOs like Bezos can make $50 billion in a calendar year while bragging about paying his workforce $15 an hour. It's important that those voices bring those to the forefront, because otherwise, man, we just get into nonsense about, you know, culture war BS that, quite frankly, I know some of that stuff is important and it matters, but it's nowhere close to as materially important as what type of healthcare people get. Can people pay for their kids' college tuition? Are people's kids' schools like up to snuff, right? Can people stay ahead on their rent, put a little money to the side to take their families on a vacation? What is the quality of life of the American working people? It's important that we keep this at the forefront of the political discourse.
I agree. Okay, with that, let's roll through to our next topic. Here's a fun one. (Clears throat) Over the past week, we've had multiple mass shootings, so we're back to that form of America. But we had in Atlanta, obviously, horrible shootings, seemingly predominantly targeting women of Asian descent. Then we had just a couple days ago, the shooting in Boulder. And now yesterday, we have a man that was toting 6 guns and wearing full body armor go into a Publix grocery store in Atlanta and arrested on charges of reckless conduct after employees there called the police. So when you hear that someone had 6 guns and body armor, you probably think, well, that probably looks pretty terrifying. Yes, it does. Actually, let's show you how terrifying it is. Here's the guns. Apparently, they're not entirely sure about exactly how many there were. Some are now saying it was something like 7, but that's a lot. I mean, effectively, the guy was cosplaying that scene in The Matrix where Neo is just littered with guns. This is one person wearing body armor and all of those guns. There was a witness who saw him in the bathroom there, Charles Russell, who said, I saw an AR-15 and I was like, you know, this kind of startled me just again with events that recently happened in the grocery store up in Colorado. And eventually the police were called. They sent him for a psychiatric evaluation. And police haven't yet said whether the individual was licensed to carry arms, but understand that Georgia is an open carry state. And whether that actually in the end will allow you to carry that many guns in a particular private establishment. The idea is, the politicians who push that sort of stuff is, it is not inherently threatening to walk around with a bunch of guns, Wozni. That's just a natural part of being an American patriot. Why are you all freaking out about somebody wearing body armor and carrying enough guns to storm a police department?
Yeah, it's funny because on the one hand, if you're a black person just standing next to a sneaker store during what they'd consider to be looting, like that's enough to get billy clubbed, get maced, get choked out. Or if you happen to be selling loose cigarettes in Staten Island, right? Like you're dangerous, you're a threat. We have the right to choke you the hell out and freaking kill you. But you know, if you're just a great law-abiding citizen in the city of Atlanta and you have 8-9 guns on your person, no, you're just being a regular citizen. And you know, I talked about this a little bit the last time I was on with Anna, but I will say, look, I think the genie's out of the bottle with the gun thing, right? I think we're at a place where essentially white people in this country have decided that this is the cost of doing business, right? We're going to have our guns and children getting mowed down at their school in Sandy Hook, that's fine. Parkland, Florida, that's fine. That's part of doing business. That's just sort of the collateral damage of what the Second Amendment freedoms bring. So people have decided that that's the cost of doing business. Okay, I don't know or see a path to convincing them otherwise. Cool. Yeah. At least we could be doing a more holistic approach with our citizenry as far as, look, man, when people have proper health care, and I'm talking about both physical and mental health, when people have great employment prospects, when you have a good job, when you have a dope crib, when you know, when your life is going pretty smoothly, you feel less inclined to do these crazy things, right? I think if we took a more holistic approach to ensuring those things for our citizens, I think we'd find that there were less people who wanted to do that kind of stuff because they had more to lose. Like they had more to look forward to in life. Like their quality of life had been so enriched by the conditions that we allowed for them as a country, right? I think if we were taking those kinds of approaches and having people that didn't feel as disconnected from society and sort of the social contract, right? That we're not gonna kill each other, that we're not gonna hurt each other, or else there's these horrible consequences. I think we would see less and less of this stuff happening. But on the one hand, we wanna flood the zone with as many freaking guns as possible. And on the other hand, we wanna leave people to their own devices and like, yo, whatever, go figure it out on your own. And I think these are the results that are being born of that, you know? And it sucks, quite frankly, John.
It does. So they stopped this one. That's good. And when I say stop, I'm sort of implying that I believe that this person was there to shoot it up, because that's totally what I believe. It's 100% speculation, but whatever. This is YouTube, Twitch. I can say whatever I want. You, who doesn't think that that's what he was going to do? Like, come on, man. That's why you bring all of those guns. Now, there are people, Republican politicians, that'll pretend that that's not why you would be wearing body armor and carrying a shotgun and a rifle and a bunch of pistols. But that is why. And we every time there's a mass shooting, we hear a lot of BS from the right, designed to stop us from trying to do anything about it. In this particular week, we heard some BS, like from Senator Kennedy was, we don't need gun control, we need idiot control. So what would Kennedy, what would you have done with this individual? Is this an idiot? I think it's pretty clear that, sure, I would use harsher words, but no, you should not be able to do this. You should not be able to go into a Starbucks with a long gun. There's no need to do that. So, but they don't actually believe that. They throw out things like idiot control because it distracts you. But there's nothing that actually would qualify under that definition that they would be willing to do something that would in any way infringe on people's ability to do things that are inherently designed to be threatening. Whether they intend to shoot up people or not, you walk around with a long gun in Target to scare people. That's why you do it. You like the idea of scaring people. Anyway, we've been talking about guns, Wazzy, like a lot this week. I'm just sick of the whole thing because nothing's gonna be done.
Yeah, and I think another thing people need to understand, and I don't want to sound like a broken record, but at the end of the day, if you commit a felony when you get out of prison, you can't even get a job. The thing that basically separates you from financial ruin, you are not allowed to do. Support yourself. Okay, you're not allowed to do it if you commit a felony, if you're convicted of that. Jobs are allowed to basically discriminate against you based upon that fact. Yet, getting a gun is, I guess it's so freaking essential that no, you have to still be able to do that. Yeah. Forget supporting yourself and supporting your family and feeding yourself and keeping yourself as a productive member of society. Nah, shoot, weed could take you out of the running for that.
Yeah,
weed could take you out of the running for certain employment. But guns, there's literally nothing you could do that would disallow you from being able to purchase guns. And again, I would remind people, when the American government considers something to be a problem, we get the crime bill. We get the war on drugs. We get all of these draconian measures.
The Patriot Act.
The Patriot Act, exactly. We get all of these draconian, just these extreme measures to stamp out what we see to be problems. But with guns, it's like, yeah, what can we do?
What can you do? Yeah.
That's all you need to know.
That's unfortunate, but yes. There is a scandal involving Governor Cuomo. I know you're shocked, right? This one is of the COVID variety. There's the two different categories. There's the awful COVID stuff and then the awful everything else about who he is as a person stuff. Well, we're gonna focus on the COVID stuff because now, in addition to all of the stories involving the numbers of people who died in nursing homes and that being covered up and all of that, we also have this. As the coronavirus pandemic swept through New York early last year, Governor Andrew Cuomo's administration arranged for his family members and other well-connected figures to have special access to state-administered coronavirus tests, dispatching a top state doctor and other state health officials directly to their homes, according to three different people. Among those who benefited were the governor's brother, the CNN anchor Chris Cuomo, and his family, who were tested several times in the pandemic's early phase. The governor's mother and at least one of his sisters were also able to take advantage of the state administered tests. And bear in mind, this was when you could not easily get tested. It's relatively easy now. It was not in the beginning, particularly in New York, considering how many people either had it or feared that they might. And we now know that a state lab immediately processed the results of those who got tested in this particular way, even as others might have to wait a long time to get their results. At times, employees in the state health laboratory were kept past their shifts until late into the night to process results of those close to Cuomo. The specimens were shrouded in secrecy, marked only by initials or numbers, and then results were then provided to the family members. So, Waz, as in a lot of his other scandals, it is clear based on that, that not only was he doing this, but he wanted to hide it as much as possible, which is why they hid the identity until the results were sent back. It seems like this is the last thing that Cuomo needs, considering everything that's been happening this last month.
Yeah, and more so than the allegation itself, which obviously sucks and is horrible. But I think it's an indication that the knives are out for this guy. Nobody, it's no holds barred now. Like, these guys, everybody is unloading and dumping on him. They could see the writing on the wall that he's toast, and they have no, like, because obviously people knew about this as it was happening, but the reason why it's coming out now is because everybody sees that, all right, it's a safe space to go in on this fool. And because, look, to be honest, nobody's surprised by the idea that people close to the governor got preferential treatment around stuff like testing, et cetera, et cetera. Like, that's honestly, I think most reasonable Americans would be like, I would expect that Cuomo took care of his family members and hooked them up via his position of power. That's going to happen. But what I will say is that I would pray, not that I pray because I'm atheist, but I'm just saying I would hope that I would hope, John, that the media would do a better job of framing the Cuomo quote unquote scandal and lead with what he did with them nursing homes. Cause that cost people's lives. People died because of that. All of the stuff with the sexual harassment and all of that stuff, those allegations, that's serious too. But that's not really in his capacity as governor of the state of New York, right? Like, yes, take him to court, do all the things, prosecute him for all of that. Yes, we want to see it. But when it comes to impeachment and why this guy needs to be taken out of office, he did not do his job. He did not execute his job as governor when it comes to the nursing home scandal. And he had the nerve to write a book about coronavirus handling. Like, he took a victory lap for how he handled the coronavirus. Like, this dude was doing a book tour because of his handling of the coronavirus. So that's what I would hope these outlets would lead with. It's about, no, this guy was derelict in his duties, in his job as governor of the state of New York. And as you know, a native New Yorker who now lives in LA, and I have family members, of course, and my closest friends that I grew up with still live in New York City. You know, this is something that I feel very passionately about. Like, this dude, he failed them miserably and horribly. And then he got on TV and read some damn notes, and everybody did a clap their hands and stomp their feet and call themselves homosexuals for it. It's embarrassing. So I'm glad that the scorn is raining down on his head finally.
Yeah, I think that point you made, that this story could have come out 6 months ago, but it's coming out now. Someone in that chain, a doctor, one of the administrators, feels free to talk about this now. And I agree, like, in comparison to the nursing home scandal, it doesn't seem that important. But in terms of buttressing the narrative that what did he care about and what did he not care about during the pandemic? Well, he cared about protecting his family. He cared about protecting their reputation. They didn't want bad information to get out. In terms of actually protecting people's lives, and much more of a mixed record. So anyway, that's not gonna help him. I did want to give them a chance to respond. So a spokesman for Cuomo said, we should avoid insincere efforts to rewrite the past. In the early days of this pandemic, when there was a heavy emphasis on contact tracing, we were absolutely going above and beyond to get people tested, including in some instances going to people's homes and door to door. No, I'm not reading any more of that. That is not what we are talking about. It's not, oh my God, he tested people. It's kind of the specific people he was testing that is the problem. So you had your chance, Rich. We're done with you. Now, on Chris Cuomo, CNN put out a statement saying, it is not surprising that in the earliest days of a once in a century global pandemic, when Chris was showing symptoms and was concerned about possible spread, he turned to anyone he could for advice and assistance, as any human being would. Come on, stop. Both of these statements are like, well, you're right. Now that you bring it up, they are great people. That's not what we're talking about. Those are not our concerns. And by the way, I like to admit potential bias even when there's no bias there. Chris Cuomo is one of like the only hosts on mainstream media that has had people from TYT on. I myself was on once right before the pandemic. That said, I don't like this. I get it, as Waz was saying, I get why the governor would do it. I get why Chris Cuomo, who had COVID, would want to be tested. I get that. But I also believe that corruption is a bad thing, even if I might kind of like the people doing some of the corruption a little bit.
No, and again, this is, you know, if he's getting his family and close friends or whatever, some type of preferential, skipping the line. I really do think reasonable people, especially as, you know, CNN so, you know, cynically outlined, like, this was an unprecedented global happening. People were doing crazy things at the time. Sure, cooler heads can prevail, and we can understand that, you know, probably 9 out of 10 people in the position of both Cuomo brothers would have done the exact same thing, right? For their family members and looking out for family. Like, we get it. And, you know, in the context of tens of millions of people who live in New York City, I don't think a few of Cuomo's sycophants and cronies, you know, getting a test before them had a major impact in people receiving their tests. Like, we can we can contextualize it and understand that. But when you put it within the context of Cuomo's governorship and his just his penchant for utter corruption, like, this is an isolated incident. I think if it was isolated, you wouldn't see it put in this context of the sexual harassment, the way he handled COVID, his bullying ways in Albany. If it was just, you know, by itself, you'd be like, who cares? This isn't even a story. Sure. But it's of a piece, right? Of something larger and more grand, and tells a bigger story about, quite frankly, a freaking horrible dude. He sucks. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah, it's like DeSantis having one of those vaccination sites set up in like a wealthy donor's neighborhood is both by itself worse than what Cuomo did. But even that, if that was the only, if DeSantis had been like totally pro science the whole time and then had done that, it would have been bad. But it's in the context of he was awful the whole time in every way he could. And annoying.
And before we move on, another thing that Cuomo did that I don't think people think about in context of this enough is, in the middle of the pandemic, this pro-corporate shill in Albany cut Medicaid. Cut Medicaid funding.
Yeah.
In the middle of the pandemic. This man has never ever done anything to make the corporate or financial interests in New York State sweat for a second. But Medicaid is provided, basically the threshold is you have to be either unemployed or make it something like 17 or 20 G's a year to qualify for it. So it's our most vulnerable citizens in New York State relying on that healthcare, and he cut it during the pandemic. This is the type of cat we're talking about here. Just disgusting. Disgusting.
Jeez. Yeah, and like, if you're gonna cut all these people's healthcare, at least send them like a signed copy of your book about how awesome you are at the coronavirus as like, you know, a consolation prize or something. I love the idea of like he hits the ball and like he celebrates as he's passing second, like he's done. Like, no, dude, there's so much more pandemic still.
To be done,
even in New York, there's so much more pandemic.
Right.
Anyway. And now it's time for news from around the world. And meanwhile, in the Suez Canal, there's a bit of an error there. Fun. Anyway, they've got an issue, and that issue is it's not the ships are getting a bit thick these days, and they're not quite fitting through. So, as many of you probably know, on Tuesday morning local time, the Ever Given, a 1,300-foot-long container ship capable of carrying more than 220,000 tons was traveling from China to the Netherlands through the canal, when Egyptian authorities say a dust storm brought low visibility and heavy winds that caused the ship to run aground. And importantly, to run aground in a way that, as you can see from this picture, basically blocked the entire canal that is a very important canal for international trade. Now, that's just a picture. You're probably wondering how this happened and how they're trying to get it out. So we do actually have a visualization from Zaina Erhaim. Take a look at this. Anyway, it's a really big container ship. Take a look at this picture. This is fascinating. It is longer than the Empire State Building is tall, Wazdy. These ships are out of control.
That's
what do you think?
That is just That is so tough. And it's so funny because you don't think about the logistics of how we get our goods to us, right? We literally one click economy, baby. Give me that one click, buy now on Amazon, and that thing just magically appears at apartment 417. And I'm happy. The endorphin hit, I get to open the box and then, you know, the packaging and everything. You never even think about how did this good even get here? What went into that? And it relies upon these modes and systems and conductors of transport to run smoothly, or else I'm on Amazon immediately. If how dare you deliver this within 4 days and not two? What the hell is your problem? Going nuts. And you don't, you never think, you take it for granted the logistics that go into delivering all of this stuff to us at our earliest convenience. And so this is, it's just wild how sort of fragile that whole system is, right? Like one little dust bowl and these guys got caught off track, and like millions in pounds of goods of cargo is being stopped right now because of a, you know, just basically what equates to a fender bender, man.
Exactly.
This is a big ass fender bender though.
It is. And well, let's show how this fender bender has messed with traffic. I want to bring up this tweet just so you can see, like, you can't, all of those are individual vessels, and some of these vessels are not quite as big as the Ever Given. The Ever Given is apparently one of the biggest in the world, but huge. It's the amount of economic damage that's been done. Our producer Sophie told us, Sophie, was it the cost to transit the Suez Canal for a ship like this is $700,000? That is crazy. Like, you think toll roads suck? Well, they're worse for ships like this. But anyway, yeah. And I also learned from our director, well over 100,000 people died building the Suez Canal. Is that crazy, Wozni? Only 1 in 10 of the prisoner laborers died to build that thing for some ship to get stuck in eventually.
That's mind blowing. Oftentimes, especially as a New Yorker, you know, people get you to think about like the Brooklyn bridges, and you always see the pictures of all those guys with the sludge on their face and the metal lunch pail, and it evokes images of these men working with their hands to build something. But wow, 100,000, that's crazy.
That is absolutely crazy. Apparently, it's going to take up to weeks to get the ship out of the canal. Although in theory, they could at least move it to the side a bit so that some smaller ships could get through. But I saw a shot of, because it's like run up on the dirt. It was like this little crane that was like digging away at the dirt. And I looked at it and I thought, that doesn't have a chance in hell of working. We were joking before the show, you need to call Superman to have any chance whatsoever. He's got to lift that thing out of there. But anyway, obviously, major problem. But meanwhile, Lynn. Meanwhile, in New Zealand, they have got a really amazing piece of legislation that is apparently going to pass. And it's very targeted in its scope, but it's so fascinating to me, like the current status of politics and what they're focusing on New Zealand versus what we're doing here in the US. So this is a policy of bereavement leave for miscarriages. Their parliament just yesterday unanimously approved legislation that would give couples who suffer a miscarriage or stillbirth 3 days of paid leave. So a few things about that shock me. One, that they have a legislature that can pass legislation. That's amazing and novel. We should look into that. Two, that something like this could be passed unanimously. And three, that is how far ahead of us they are on the legislature caring about the actual quality of life, as Wozni was talking about earlier, of like their constituents, that someone who experiences this, that is a terrible thing to have to experience. Now in America, we would expect, Wozni, I think, just get back to work, just grind it out, forget about this life experience, we don't care. Maybe you can take sick leave, you know, the very limited number of days you have, you could take that. But here in New Zealand, they actually care about that. They wanna give you and your partner time off to deal with this amazingly traumatic experience.
It's the so obviously humane thing to do. Like the alternative of get back to your job. You know, I know we fetishize work here in America. We fetishize productivity, which to me is a nasty word, or efficiency and all of those kinds of things. We fetishize that stuff here. And over there, clearly they're like, There are things more than work, more important than work, like the loss of a child unexpectedly. Yeah. Like, you can't imagine how sad and, you know, just horrific an experience that would be for parents, particularly for the woman who was carrying the child. Like, it goes without saying. Even stuff like maternity leave, which is, you know, in a way connected to this. We don't have universal maternity leave standards here in America. And where there are, because, you know, the industries of capitalism have decided, like, all right, we gotta give these chicks at least a month. You know, like, they've all decided, yeah, we'll throw a month at them. When that's, like, completely and utterly inadequate, you know, when you think about what it takes to bear a child. So it's, you know, it's ridiculous. But this is so clearly and obviously the right thing to do. Like, there's no point in even discussing the merits of it, right? Like, there is no downside to this. This is only good.
Well, yeah, no reason to discuss the merits in a reasonable world, in a world that maybe we can, like, conceive of, but obviously don't live in. So after the show, I'm going to tweet about this and try to get one of the awesome progressives in Congress, maybe a member of the squad, to put forward a piece of legislation like this. And I will guess that if they do that, it ain't gonna be passed unanimously. It ain't gonna be passed at all. It would be filibustered. And when they obviously filibuster it, then people like Kristen Sinema can pretend, oh yeah, no, I totally approve the legislation. I just won't get rid of the filibuster to make sure that it actually passes. But anyway, I wanted to give a little bit of credit to the Labor member of parliament who drafted the bill, Jenny Anderson, who had this to say about the goal of it. I felt that it would give women the confidence to be able to request that leave if it was required, as opposed to just being stoic and getting on with life when they knew that they needed time physically or psychologically to get over the grief. The bill will give women and their partners time to come to terms with their loss without having to tap into sick leave, because their grief is not a sickness, it is a loss, and loss takes time. And by the way, I did a little bit of research looking into some other places that have things similar to this. In Australia, people who miscarry are entitled to unpaid leave if they lose a fetus after 12 weeks, while in Britain, would-be parents who experience a stillbirth after 24 weeks are eligible for paid leave. The United States does not require employers to provide leave for anyone who suffers a miscarriage or suffers anything, just suffers. There's no requirement for the industry to do basically anything. But few people are going to be surprised by that.
Well, John, you know, suffering here in America is a feature. It's not a glitch. It's what makes you a hard scrabble, tough nosed, lunch pail type of guy, John. Don't you know that? Or that's are true. You just one of these sissy, lip-ris liberals? You don't love suffering. You just want to be happy. You just want to smile and laugh and be with loved ones and feel good about yourself. You don't want to get your hands in the dirt and
you know, we've just met, but he's got a pretty good read of me. Yeah, I just want to smile and laugh and not get my hands in the dirt. That's me, really. There may be some donuts along the way too, but that's pretty much what I want, Wozni. Thank you for encapsulating that in that way. Anyway, meanwhile, in Mexico, scientists have solved a problem that we've been faced with since the beginning of the pandemic, which is we're supposed to wear masks, but sometimes you have to do things that involve your mouth, like eating and drinking. And if you're gonna do that around people, then, like, are you taking off the mask to then drink? Like, that's a problem. Well, they've found a solution for it, and you can see it here. Laughing, but there's something hilarious about that, Wozni.
It's the eyes wide shut mask, but for your boogers. It's craziness, man. What is that? Come on, guys.
It's like, I don't want to get the coronavirus, but I want to pretend that I'm in a Clockwork Orange. It just looks like a big fake nose, is what it looks like. Especially the blue one. It looks like she has a big fake blue nose on.
Yeah, but you know, we got to give them credit for the effort, John. At sure. least they're trying something. Hopefully, you know, some of the leading people in design and fashion could look at this and come up with a much cooler way for people to eat and be safe. Because I'm sorry, man, I am a bit too vain to walk outside with, you know, basically a mask on my nose. Like that just it's just not gonna happen.
Yeah, I would say, look, if you're gonna try to get us to wear those, really commit to it, make it fun. Have like a little fake mustache and some glasses that attach to the nose that you put on. Maybe that could work. Anyway, look, I'm joking. Obviously, I want people to wear masks and be safe. If that were to get more people to do that, that would be good. I will say I am glad that they are developing this at what seems like the end, near the end of the pandemic. So maybe we don't have to start wearing those. But anyway. Great work. Anyone who's working in design, making masks in a way that more people want to wear, great. I got one off of Etsy that looks like the Marauders map from Harry Potter. So thank you to everybody who made masks. I think I'm going to skip this particular one though, but maybe that's just me. Anyway, Wozni, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate you joining us on the show. The response from the audience has been awesome. I've been watching the chat throughout. Although that shouldn't be surprising because we know from your appearances on TYT that you're awesome. So thank you.
Hey man, thank you for having me. This was a blast, obviously. Please have me back anytime. I'm a slam dunk dragon now. don't worry, I'm on my way to get that tatted right now, right? As soon as I hang up on this call, I'm going to the tattoo parlor. I'm gonna get it tatted. Right on my neck. So anytime I'm on the show, you'll be able to see a dope dragon, the slam dunk dragon neck tat.
Well, I'll get one too, and I'll get it across my nose. That way, okay. If I have to cover it up, I know a way.
There you go.
Well, until next time, where can people see more of your work?
Yeah, I'm at The Athletic. I know we're a subscription-based company, but listen, it's the best sports coverage in the world, particularly the NBA coverage. And I don't just say that because I'm biased. I really truly think me and my colleagues, the talent level that's on our staff covering the NBA is second to none. So please check us out at The Athletic. We're doing a dollar special right now. $1 a month will get you an Athletic subscription. So please check out The Athletic. I do a podcast with the Hall of Famer David Aldridge called Hoops Adjacent on the Athletic NBA show podcast feed that comes out every single Wednesday. Please check that out. We talk to all the luminaries across the NBA, from players to general managers to other, you know, respected media members. So please go check that out. And if you have even a passing interest in lefty media, which obviously you do because you mess with TYT, check me and Nando out on the Woke Bros. That's just Woke Bros. Anywhere you look for your podcast. Anywhere, whether awesome. It be Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, check that out. And on social, hit me up, get at me, man. I love talking to the TYT community on social. I'm BIGWOS on Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, any single social media platform. You can find me, BIGWOS, man. Check me out,
awesome.
Y'all.
Awesome. Wozni, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Just last week on the Damage Report, we talked about how Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was working to ban the teaching of critical race theory in the state. And he received a good amount of applause for that, which is interesting considering how much the right has taken up their fight for free speech as sort of a core part of their politics recently. It seems like there's a bit of a disconnect there. And joining us to discuss is once again from insider politics columnist Anthony Fisher. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thanks, good to be here.
We're always glad to have you here. And you recently wrote about the anti-woke activists and this recent turn. Tell me a little bit about this.
Yeah, well, I guess it was inevitable that the word anti-woke was going to become part of the lexicon.
I hate it.
it's also like woke and cancel culture have both completely served their purpose. They are not helpful phrases or words for conversing about these topics. But in this particular case, I was speaking mostly about Republicans and even some libertarians, even which I found most disappointing, because they've are by and large, in my view, the most rocked ribbed about free speech, willing to defend their ideological beliefs. But in this case, a lot of them have gone to the point where they believe that critical race theory is such a threat to civilization, literally using the phrase threat to Western civilization, that they would make an exception on their free speech principles and support the banning of critical race theory, the 1619 Project, related social justice initiatives from being taught or discussed in public trainings, which would include public universities. Now, to be very clear, there are, I believe, reasonable arguments to be made about the teaching of critical race theory in K-12 schools, but it's a completely different conversation, because K-12 schools, teachers and students don't really have First Amendment rights in those schools. The curriculum actually can be dictated by the government. Mm-hmm. That's just part of how it goes. But to say that adults cannot be taught or cannot learn or cannot discuss certain ideas, certain theories that they consider, some of the phrases they use are anti-American or neo-racist. And it's one of those cases where they don't really see the irony in that so much of their efforts over free speech for the last 10 or 20 years have been pushing back on the left, narrowing the contours of political speech, then lowering the bar about what is acceptable to be discussed. And their reaction here is that it's okay when we do it this one time. And I pointed out, just as I had pointed out in earlier essays where I was kind of talking to the left, and I basically said that whenever you demand this kind of power over speech, eventually the man, the authority, will be your political enemy, and they will use it against you. It's not going to stamp out what you think it's going to stamp out, but it will give increased power to authority to regulate speech. And that's what I was basically, and trying to break down as specific as I could. In particular, Iowa bans the teaching or the discussion of divisive topics. Now, if that isn't broadly written to include that could be discussed.
DC versus Marvel. Nope, yeah. Can't discuss it. Too divisive.
Yeah.
So that was Now, look, obviously there are restrictions on free speech. Restrictions can be made. This seems like a particularly broad one. Anytime you do something like this is to talk about the possibility of some sort of slippery slope. This one seems as if that is the only possibility going forward. If what you're saying is you can't teach something because it's anti-American, seems like that might depend on a few different things about what you consider to be American, what you consider to be acceptable. Colleges are full of ways of thinking, philosophical frameworks that are supposed to recontextualize information that we believed we already knew. This is not the first time. The 1619 Project isn't the first time we attempted to better understand something from our past. It almost seems as if the recontextualization is not the problem. It's the subject matter specifically that seems to be frustrating them so much, that it specifically has to do with the legacy of white supremacy in American government and the possibility that elements of it might remain.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, a lot of people are coming out of this for a lot of different reasons. I think that some of the people who are calling for these anti-woke bills are exactly as you've described. They just don't want to deal with America's legacy of racism, legacy of racial inequity. They don't want to deal with any of that. But then I do think that there are others that say that certain aspects of critical race theory trainings, like for an example that I use that's actually a real world example, an 8-year-old public school student being asked as part of a school lesson to stand in front of the class and denounce their own whiteness or white privilege. I think there are reasonable arguments or conversations that should be had about, if that's the right way to teach social justice or reckon America's history of racism. But that's a very narrow conversation.
Sure.
Broad conversation that is happening is because it's law. When we're dealing with law, the words are absolute, they're unbreakable, they can be interpreted differently, but when they're broadly written, they're going to be broadly applied. And it's just madness to me to for these people, especially so many of them consider themselves free speech warriors, to not see the slippery slope that, like you said, is a foot away from them. It's not even like something you need to have much of an imagination to see happening down the road, where anti-Americanism, like it cracks me up because people act like America doesn't have a rich history of, like, you know, labor unions, like the FDR. Mm-hmm. Were the FDR years not American? You know, whenever someone tries to define what is American or say that something is too anti-American to be discussed, it's a huge red flag for me. Yeah. I at that point, I think you've lost the ability to say you're a good faith actor.
Sure. I certainly agree, especially when, like, with the DeSantis one in particular, he was banning some things that aren't even happening. Like, it's not like he wants to strike back against something that's gone too far. It's he's banning things that aren't being taught. And my assumption is that he is doing that. And you know, this is me speculating, not necessarily because he feels it has to be done or because this is an issue that he personally feels so motivated by, but that I believe that those on the right get worked up about this, that Republican voters probably take this very seriously. I don't know to what extent any polling has been done about that. The 1619 Project's been around for a bit. It's something that's been talked about. Do we have any idea? We can speculate about the leaders or media members, but for regular conservatives or even non-conservatives, do we have any idea what they think about the teaching of critical race theory in these different contexts that you've been discussing?
I don't have numbers on just critical race theory, but I can tell you that culture war stuff is very popular with the Republican base. And part of it has to do with the fact that Joe Biden, even though he's a lifelong liberal and there's plenty to criticize about his record, he just doesn't whip up the passion, you know, the animus that previous Democratic presidents had. Barack Obama, you know, it was easy for the right to get whipped up about him. Joe Biden, they're just not able to get whipped up about him. So there's a conscious choice to lean into culture war arguments. And, you know, this is the culture war argument of the moment, you know, and DeSantis, sure. Say what you want about the guy. He's proving to be a very adept politician. You know, he's, you know, what he weathered, you know, a lot of early criticism about his, you know, anti-lockdown policies. And now he's sort of taking a victory lap with, you know, Andrew Cuomo's administration in disarray and Florida's numbers never really getting much worse than the national average. So on top of that, he's, you know, making a big show out of banning critical race theory from, you know, public schools and trainings. And he's doing that also because it's popular. You know, these things may not even survive court challenges, depending on how many there are and where they go. But that's not the point. The point is to show the base that you hear their outrage and you're going to take swift and brutal response to it.
And finally, like, sort of looking forward, many of the attempts to limit this sort of thing have been at the local or especially the state level, which makes sense because so much of education policy is determined at the state level. But we obviously do have a Department of Education. In theory, this is something that maybe Biden or some future president could get involved in. Do you see any indication that this is something that the federal government could weigh in on, or that in theory, a good politician like DeSantis could try to make some, in theory, if they were to run for president, could try to make some sort of national issue out of?
It's a good question, but it's real early, you know, like, as you know, the news cycles and the political news cycles, the idea that even for the midterms that this would be a big cultural political issue is, it's just too early to say. This could run its course in 6 months or it could stay. And if it does stay, then yeah, I would see Biden getting involved. But until then, I would see actually Biden staying absolutely quiet about this issue because he doesn't have to wait. Because it's not, he doesn't have much influence over it. He can only kind of steer public conversation in a certain direction. And he's got the slimmest of congressional majorities. So I would see him not expelling any political capital on this at all. But I would see Republicans expelling tons of it and trying to build up the bubble of outrage over it. And, you know, I'm not particularly interested in either of those things. I felt the need to write this column because I felt that a threat to free speech was happening, and it was happening at the hands of people who have sometimes been my allies in free speech, but who, you know, in this particular case, I vehemently disagree with. And one final point, you know, I spoke with, you know, one of the legislative directors at FIRE, the, you know, nonpartisan free speech group, and he said that, you know, for even if you were to argue against critical race theory and say that it's wrong to be taught in public trainings, you have legal avenues already available. If you feel that a hostile work environment has been created, you can make that complaint. You don't need a broad sweeping law to deal with this if you feel like you've been wronged by it.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the article is available at Insider. If you'd like to see more examples that Anthony broke down of how this is playing out in different states, that's available now. And as always, Anthony, we really appreciate you joining us.
Always good to be here. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.